Turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 7 and verse 1. 1 Samuel, chapter 7, verse 1. And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and fetched up the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab in the hill and sanctified Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. The Philistines have returned the ark. It has been taken to a priestly city in Israel, but there it met with great irreverence and a lack of form and order, and that led to catastrophe, and the priests in that city wanted it sent away, and it was sent to this city of Kirjath-Jearim, not a priestly city, but where it got far better treatment, and it was given a house, and it was given a carer, and it was treated, it appears, with great reverence. And verse 2 here, it came to pass, while the ark abode in Kirjath-Jearim, that the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. In other words, it took 20 years for them to desire that it should be taken to Ramah, the high place where Samuel exercised his ministry. And until that happened, of course, the token of the presence of the Lord was not with his people. They had worship, they had sacrifices, but they did not have the presence of the Lord. What a tragedy. No evidence of God's great goodness with them, no joy, no fruit of a walk with him, no fellowship with God, not on any to any extent, while the ark of God remained in this provincial place. And then the people who were practicing idolaters began to long and yearn for the presence and the blessing of God, and they were moved by the Lord. Look at verse 3, the preaching of Samuel. Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, he no doubt was doing this continually throughout the 20-year period, if ye do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord. It would take some doing. They would have to prove to God their absolute undivided loyalty to him. Serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines and their oppression. And then at long last, in verse 4, Baalim and Ashtaroth are put away. Not for long, tragically, but they were. But look at the terms for discipleship in the second part of verse 3. Put away the strange gods, in our case, any worldliness, love of earthly things over the things of God. Prepare your hearts. Search your hearts, repent of course, pray for advance in the spiritual walk, serve him only, not alter. We've got to look after our homes and families and make a contribution in the world in a civic sense, but we have to put him first. Serve him only, not go all out for promotion and substance, and in those circumstances as Christians he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines, and in our case he will deliver us as his people out of the hand of Satan and the influence of Satan to oppress our work and prevent our progress. And Samuel said, verse 5, gather all Israel to Mizpeh, and I will pray for you unto the Lord. They were ready to respond. Mizpeh, a 3,000-foot mountain. And prayer is so vital, it's essential. And verse 6, a wonderful picture of their pride being renounced. And they drew water and poured it out before the Lord, probably signifying their acknowledgement of wasted years, wasted times in repentance. And they fasted and they acknowledged that they'd sinned. And it's going to be accepted, this repentance. At this point, it was obviously sincere, because God is going to bless as the result. And Samuel judged the children of Israel in Mizpeh. But as soon as there was all this consecration and repentance and genuine devotion of heart, verse 7 occurs. When the Philistines heard that the children of Israel were gathered together to Mizpah, well, they attempt this preemptive strike. The lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And that happens in life. As soon as we reconsecrate, take things more seriously, dedicate ourselves afresh, there'll be a big test, a test of faith, perhaps some calamity, some trial, some great opportunity that will entice us away from the Lord, possibly. Something will happen, and it certainly happened here. Suddenly, the Philistines, who'd given them a little bit of rest, though they were on their borders and had taken many of their cities, now stirred again and assembled for battle. And in verse 8, the children of Israel said to Samuel, "Cease not to cry unto the Lord our God for us, that he will save us out of the hands of the Philistines." You might react to that and say, well, with all that repentance, we're not seeing much courage and faith in the Lord. But actually, we may take it as a good sign, because the problem prior to this, in earlier episodes, had been their self-confidence. They could defeat the Philistines by themselves, and they went straight into it, and they were sorely hurt. But now, at least, they haven't got this false confidence. They know they need the Lord. And Samuel took a sucking lamb in verse 9, offered it for a burnt offering, an offering of consecration, no doubt. And verse 10, even as he did this, the Philistines drew near to battle, and there was this great thunder that discomfited the Philistines. Well, it must have been a fantastic rending of the heavens and a thunder to terrify an army on the move. And they were smitten before Israel. And in verse 11, the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and smote them until they came under Bethgar, quite a considerable distance at last. But though the Israelites prayed earnestly for Samuel's intercession and for God's help, they were well aware that they would have to act themselves, that they would have to fight. And that's a lesson too, which we often mention, which we find repeatedly with the people of God in the Old Testament. They needed God's help. They were dependent upon him. Self-confidence, self-reliance would lead to disaster. But there was human instrumentality. They had to fight that battle. That needs to be learned all over again today. And we have in this land many good, earnest Christian people who pray for revival and are not ready to lift a finger to serve the Lord, get their churches organized, open and enlarge Sunday schools, visit neighborhoods. And yet if you were to attend their prayer meetings, you'd see hear very wholehearted prayer for revival. But what a tragedy! Because God does use his people as instruments. He doesn't want us self-reliant and self-confident, yes, dependent upon him, but ready to serve and ready to act and to witness and evangelize. And wherever the Lord takes you in future years, never let go of dedicated human instrumentality and your part in the work of the Lord. These things are so vital. Well, in verse 12 there, and I'm rushing a little in chapter 7 because I want to get to the next chapter, but in verse 12, Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." And he wanted that to be embossed upon the minds of the people to remember the Lord's help and this astonishing victory, and how it was unmistakably through the power of God, though they had to be involved in the fighting. So thanksgiving is vital, not only prayer, but earnest thanksgiving. Do you pray for things, receive the help of God, and forget to thank him, and begin to take the credit yourself, perhaps, that things worked out well, or you were fluent in that act of witness, and quite successful and made an impression. And taking the credit yourself, there's this great thanksgiving, and a memorial is established so that it will be long remembered. And it's important to remember blessings, because that strengthens your faith. The next time you need to be totally cast upon the Lord, and it delivers you from self-confidence and self-reliance. And so the memorials of the Old Testament are very important lessons for us. Now I look down to chapter 7 and verse 13. So the Philistines were subdued. They were not entirely defeated. They were there, but they were quiet on their borders. In fact, there was a certain amount of reclaiming of land from them. They came no more into the coast of Israel, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines to hold them back all the days of Samuel. But they were there. They needed to be pressed completely back. That would happen in due time. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel. And then you read down in verse 15 that Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, the last of the judges. And you read something in verse 16 of his circuit, where he would go to judge the people. And verse 17, his home at Ramah, and there he had the place of worship, the chief place of worship. But it's the 8th chapter which is so significant for us this evening. The 8th chapter is introducing a tremendous shift in affairs in the Old Testament already. The 8th chapter and the 9th chapter and the 10th come to that. You have the overlap of the period of the judges and the monarchy. Now, Samuel is the last of the judges. That period is coming to an end, and Saul will be the first king. That's the new period, the monarchy. And what lay behind this change and what happened through it, these things are most important to us, not because we're students of history only, but because there are spiritual lessons to be learned. Verse 1 of chapter 8, and it came to pass, when Samuel was old, actually he was about 60, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn Joel, name of the second Abiah, and they were appointed as judges in Beersheba. So they were not like Eli's sons, judging in the capital and acting as priests, Levite priests. But they were sent down to Beersheba, about 60 miles south. Probably Samuel was of such an age that he could no longer travel that far and make good progress, go all the way down to Beersheba, regular intervals. So he sent two of his sons down. He didn't lay too great a burden upon them, because if they were to exercise this ministry of judgment in the deep south, well, there were both of them together, and they were there. Now, we're not told much about the background to this, but we may assume that Samuel, who was a man of God, not with a neglectful, careless side like the genial Eli appears to have had, was a man of God who's commended in the letter to the Hebrews as a man of exemplary spiritual faith and insight, we must assume that he'd brought up these sons well, and that while they were with him, this is assumption, but it's a reasonable assumption, they behaved well, and they gave good promise. And so when Samuel sent them down to Beersheba to relieve his travels somewhat, he had every hope that they would be good, faithful, honest judges, and they would be successful. But they failed him. It appears, perhaps over time, that they fell into making money for themselves, taking bribes which would have been offered by the wealthy, the prosperous, favours at first, seemingly innocent favours probably, would embroil a judge, and then perhaps monetary favours that got larger and larger. until the two young men were completely swamped by them. How young they were, 30 to 40, I suppose, if Samuel, we calculate, was around 60. But they let him down. Now, we don't have to consider that this was Samuel's fault, but he was let down. And when complaints were brought against his sons, it was not, Samuel, you need to change your sons. You need other judges down there. They're misbehaving. Here is the evidence. Oh no, this was a tremendous excuse for the elders of Israel to make a pitch for what they wanted anyway, a king. It was a great groundswell among the people, desire for a king, which we'll come to in a moment. But these sons, it's very tragic, isn't it, that people who probably were so keen and so faithful, or appeared to be so diligent, should turn out badly. But it happens. It can happen to some degree even among us. When you study church history, you see it. You see some great preachers and theologians, and their young men go through college and all the rest of it, and lo and behold, some of them become leading liberals. What a tragedy, denying the essentials of the faith. Yes, we don't want it to happen. We want the best for our children, but they can let us down. And I see it in another way too. I've seen people, I'm old enough to have seen this now, seen people who, when they were young, they were zealous young men and young women. But by the time they were middle-aged, they were a little bit cynical. Oh, that energetic and fervent phase of their 20s, they rather look back on it with faint amusement now. Why, they've made it in the world. They've got big jobs, big incomes. They've gradually, over the years, spoilt themselves with many fine acquisitions, better than those which other people have. And their first love and their first ardour has died away. And so, less and less are they any use to the Lord and to his church. You see it. Well, there's a horrible picture of this with Samuel's sons, who I think it's fair to say would have been sent off to their work with high hopes, but they let their father down in their case. Well, verse 4, it's an excuse for the elders. By the way, Samuel's sons were not subverting the temple worship or anything like Eli's sons were doing. However, what they did was very bad. Verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us. And here's the key phrase, like all the nations. What a tragedy this was going to be. How would this help them? Samuel's sons could be replaced easily enough, but how would having a king help them? If their reason is the taking of bribes by subsidiary judges, how would a king help them? They were surrounded by Canaanite kingdoms which were as corrupt as the day is long. None of those kingdoms exactly advertised the merits of monarchy. They were terrible places. So, what do they mean? Make us a king, like the nations round about us. Had they thought about this? Oh, yes, they had. But unfortunately, the issues they were looking at were not the efficiency of a king, or whether or not he would be likely to take bribes. What they were thinking about is how much more liberty they would get, not in personal and civic terms, but in terms of religion. They didn't want this Judge Samuel, who went about the country preaching against idolatry. They were idolaters. He was unpopular with them for all his wisdom and his care of them and his judgments. And he's able to say in chapter 12, I have never taken a bribe, never been subverted, or anything of that kind, and no one could bring any charges against him. So what they wanted was flexibility to cheat against the Lord and to carry on doing so. They hadn't honestly thought, would we be better off in the affairs of judgment with a king? That wasn't the issue for them. Now we read in verse 6, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us, and lead us to say, the lightweight modern commentators tend to start drawing a picture of Samuel, poor old man, very peeved, very irritated, pride wounded, didn't like the thought that he was going to be set on one side. Whereas the letter to the Hebrews says, man of exemplary faith. So we don't rush, like the moderns do, to pin all sorts of dreadful attitudes onto Samuel. No, give us a king to judge us. That displeased Samuel because he knew his Bible, or such of it that existed at that time. He knew that this was bound to come. Deuteronomy 17, the Lord had said so in predictive words, when thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, as all the nations that are about me. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. Now, the prophecies are there. It is predictive from Moses that the time would come in the land that the people would be dissatisfied with the deliverers, the saviors of God's provision, and they would want a king. Now this would be a bad thing. It would be a bad thing because the people would want a king for the wrong reasons. It would be a bad thing because monarchy would be infinitely inferior to the rule of the judges and the period of the judges. It would be a bad thing for a number of reasons which we'll go into. And yet God, in his will, would give them a king. He would indeed give them a king. It was, in a sense, the will of God, but it was a vastly inferior arrangement. So why would God give it to them then? Well, partly to punish them. And that's the warning which Samuel gives them. They'll have all sorts of restrictions on them and expenses and burdens which they never had before during the period of kingdom. And it would be, in a sense, to punish the people. Also, of course, it would have the people desiring the true king that would come. The kings that they would have, well, the best of them would be a kind of type of Christ. But more than that even, they would like the law, which was supposed to be a schoolmaster to show people their need of God's forgiving love. A king will be such a king most of the time that they would yearn for the King of Kings, for the Messiah who was ultimately promised. And they would know and they would learn that no human king can never fulfill the aspirations of the people and satisfy their requirements and give them their heart's desire. Oh yes, but there's another purpose why the monarchy was to be permitted, and it's this: to teach the church lessons. When the church age would begin, after the coming of Christ at Pentecost, there would be a pattern church established. And you know what? The hearts even of Christians would be constantly drawn away from the pattern which God had provided for something much more like that which goes on in the world. We want the church to be governed in the way that the nations are governed. We want them to be governed this way and that way and this structure and that structure. And one of the purposes of the monarchy, because all the things in the Old Testament, you remember, are written for our learning, one of the purposes of the monarchy is to say this to us: don't abandon the system which God gives you for New Testament churches. You might say, independent, autonomous churches, that's not efficient. We need a denomination. We need a central HQ. Surely you can see with multinational companies, you get one board organizing everything. Look how they grow. Look how they train people. Look how it all works out. And you may think, that's what we need in the church. we need to say, though there's no pattern church in the New Testament, this idea of independency, autonomous churches, directly answerable to Christ, that's no organization. You be careful. The transition from the ancient theocracy under the judges to the monarchy is partly to tell us, don't tamper with the Lord's provisions and the genius of his plan. Everything you think will work won't work. And everything you imagine won't work, through prayer and with the Lord, will work wonderfully. And this is perhaps the greatest lesson of the period of the transition from the judges to the monarchy, to the kings. So we pursue it with very great interest, and we're reading about it in this 8th chapter. Well, verse 20, that we may be like all the nations. This is what they want. They don't want to be a peculiar people, different from all the nations, explaining themselves, subject to ridicule. They want to be like all the nations. Sometimes people feel that in the church. Why can be worshipped like the world, behave like the world? Why do we have to be different? Why do people who are worldlings have to come into the churches and find our culture, our everything, is distinctive and different? Well, that's what they thought, and they sacrificed the most precious things they had, foolishly. And then they wanted a king, verse 20, chapter 8, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. We want a professional army. That's what it turns out to mean as the chapters go on. We want a standing army. We want professionals. We want an expert general king, somebody who with great valour and proficiency. We don't want to be trembling in our beds and, Israel, to your tents, O Israel. And we, humble farmers, out we've got to go with swords and spears and trust on the Lord to help us. We're nervous about that. And of course they would be. They're idolaters. They're two-timing the Lord constantly. And we feel more secure if we've got a professional army. And Samuel heard all the words of the people. Well, the Lord said to Samuel, verse 22, hearken unto their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man unto his city. Well, some people, they say that God did mean them to have a king. The only complaint that God made against the Israelites at that time, they say, is that they wanted a king too early. People seriously say this. They say, oh, David, if they'd just waited for David to come along. The scriptures which reprove the Israelites for wanting a king, they're misunderstood. The reproof is only because they went too early and for the wrong reasons. They should have waited for David, and then monarchy is just wonderful and fine. Now, it may be no surprise to you to know that the commentators who liked that point of view, kings were good, really, and God meant them all along. People preaching like I am tonight have got the wrong end of the stick altogether. But the people who like the monarchy and the kings, guess what? They're denominationalists. They don't like basically the message that the transition from the judges to the monarchy is like a transition from independent churches, according to the Bible pattern, to a denomination. Make us a denomination. Let us have a central government, an authority, instructions down from the top, something that'll join all our voices together, be noticeable in the world, and powerful and respected. Well, people who think like that, naturally, think the monarchy was a good thing. But it wasn't a good thing, and there's no doubt the Bible is against it. And in Deuteronomy, God isn't saying, I want a king. That's my first intention for you people. He is speaking predictively. The people will ask for a king, and I will give them one. It's not an approval of the monarchy, though God intends to give it for the reasons I've stated, partly to reprove them, partly to teach the New Testament Church of Jesus Christ precious lessons, and partly to provide a type of what Christ will be, the perfect king. The type will be very imperfect and even cause people, or should cause people, to desire the coming of Christ. Hosea 13, you needn't turn to it, this will be quite quick. Hosea 13, verse 9, O Israel, thou hast destroyed thyself, says the prophet, but in me is thine help. I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities, and judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and prince? I gave thee a king in mine anger and took him away in my wrath. There's no doubt about it. God gave them a king in anger. What did they want? Pomp and majesty. Control. Cohesion. Give us a king. Unite the tribes together. What did the monarchy do? It divided the tribes. Every single thing you read about in 1 Samuel chapter 8 that they desired and which Samuel warned them would happen, happened. We want cohesion and unity. They got division. We want a king to fight our battles for us. Surprise, surprise, Saul was slain in battle, the first king. No judge had ever been slain in battle. And Saul wasn't the first king to be slain in battle. Everything they thought would be an advantage turned out to be a disadvantage in the monarchy. And as I pointed out to you before, 3-1 is the ratio of blessing to blessing between the judges and the monarchy. 3 times more blessing under the judges, 3 times more good than bad in every conceivable sense. Well, what did the king get them? They trusted the king, not prayer, not God. They got officers of state, which those elders no doubt wanted to be. They thought the king would strike terror to their enemies. Well, we don't have a king. We can't frighten our enemies. They got a king. He didn't frighten their enemies, except in the case of David. Kings accommodated idolatry, as I pointed out already. Well, friends, look at chapter 9. Now, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, is a long introduction for Saul. The son of Abiel, the son of Zerah, the son of Bechoreth, the son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. What a description. Very, very wealthy, very powerful. And he had a son. I think the way is being prepared for us to see a rather spoilt boy emerge. Verse 2 of chapter 9, he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man. On what basis is he a choice young man? What would he be chosen for? And a goodly. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. Now we learn everything. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. His physical stature was extraordinarily striking. He was extremely handsome. There you are. That's Saul. You don't read anything about his academic record. You don't read anything about his wisdom, his virtue, his piety, his experience in running anything. He seems, in chapter 9, to be making a bit of a mess of looking for his father's lost asses or donkeys. You don't actually read that he's particularly strong. But he's certainly got a very tall, commanding physique and no doubt some charm to go with it. So Saul is introduced. Saul is all appearance. But that's just what the people wanted. That's just what would appeal to them. Samuel, now of course I would say this because I'm an old person, but Samuel, though 60 years of age, was just perfect for them. I'm not claiming this of myself, mark you, but he was wise. He was experienced. He had a tremendous track record. Samuel was everything. They should really have appreciated him. But I imagine, I don't know, I imagine that he was bald and he was lined from living in the hot sun for so many years. And perhaps he stooped a bit and shambled, who knows? And he was dressed, I think, cleanly, but undoubtedly very simply. And he didn't cut an impressive figure. And show was everything. "You're old," they said to Samuel. "We can't be proud of you," in the way they wanted to be proud of a king. Saul was the opposite. He would be a perfect choice for them, just what they wanted. But of course, there's nothing about his heart, or his wisdom, or his strength of character, which proved to be extremely poor, or any of the other desired qualifications for being a king. But then it's all appearance, and that's the taste of the people. Now, you possibly know the chapter, and you know that his father, powerful as he was, had lost some donkeys. How many? I don't know. Maybe hundreds. Been stolen, possibly. Someone had made off with them. And so Saul is sent off to locate them. I don't know what that would have involved. Just make inquiries, find out. If there's any line of inquiries successful, then his powerful father could take other effective steps to get them rounded up rather than put his treasured son at risk. But by verse 5 in chapter 9, you find that Saul is ready to give up. And when they were come to the land of Zuph, which is very near to Ramah, it turns out, Saul said to his servant that was with him, "Come and let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses and take thought for us." I think he was a sport boy. "My dad's worrying about me by now." Yes, they'd been here and there, they'd covered some ground. But the servant seems to have more strength in him. And he said unto him, verse 6, "Behold now, there is in this city," Ramah was near, "a man of God," that's Samuel, "and he is an honourable man," that was well known, but Saul doesn't appear to have heard of him. I don't think much of his father, Kish. He doesn't seem to have been much of a worshipper, possibly an idolater. Anyway, he's an honourable man. Saul hadn't heard much of this. "All that he saith cometh surely to pass. Now let us go thither. Peradventure, he can show us our way that we should go." Verse 7, "Then Saul said to his servant, 'But behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man?'" Saul seems to be, yes, you can see it's good manners to bring a gift to the man of God, but Saul seems to be treating him like a kind of cheap fortune teller. He doesn't seem to grasp who he is and his significance spiritually. Do you think I'm exaggerating? "What shall we bring the man?" Verse 7, "For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there is not a present to bring to the man of God. What have we?" And the servant seems to have a store of silver on him. Again, it's tempting to think that Saul's father said to the servant, you know what a shambles Saul can be sometimes. In case you get into difficulty, you better carry some spare cash," and gives him quite a bit. He's a scatterbrain. Maybe not, but possibly. Anyway, you come down to verse 11, and as they went up the hill to the city, this would be Ramah, they found young maidens going out to draw water, and said unto them, "Is the seer here?" And they answered them and said, "He is. Behold, he is before you. Make haste now, for he came today to the city, for there is a sacrifice of the people today in the high place." Nice, isn't it? The maidens know all about the spiritual activities of Samuel. Saul, this man from a very wealthy, powerful family in Benjamin, he doesn't seem to know anything. Verse 13, "As soon as ye be come into the city, ye shall straightway find him before he go up to the high place to eat." And what you're reading here is how approachable Samuel was. What a transition this is going to be. They're going to give up this simple, humble, approachable prophet and judge. and they're going to exchange him for a king who's going to take all their young men, who's going to have farms and servants, who's going to have the right to just confiscate land and to conscript people into his military, left, right and centre, a remote person. He's going to have their choicest young men running before his chariot to proclaim his approach. He's so high and mighty. That's what will happen during the period of the monarchy, and of course all the taxes to pay for it. And in verse 8 we read just how great those taxes would be. That's the beginning of taxation for Israel of old, the monarchy. They never paid any taxes. They never had anything like that. They paid the religious temple dues and for the pastors, but they didn't pay anything else. And now it was going to cost them everything. But here's Saul, who would be the king, and he has no idea. He doesn't know Samuel. He's never seen him. Doesn't seem to have been up to worship. Samuel is told, verse 15, a day before Saul came, verse 16, tomorrow about this time, I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin, and thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people Israel, that he may save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry is come unto me. How humbly and readily Samuel is going to surrender his power of leadership and humble himself before this young man. He's a godly man, Samuel. He knows it's the will of God that the people have to be taught. Verse 17 of chapter 9, when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, Behold, the man whom I spake to thee of, this same shall reign over my people. And Saul, in verse 18, of course doesn't know Samuel, doesn't recognize him. Tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is. Samuel wears no special or distinctive robe. He doesn't wear any equivalent to a clerical collar or anything like this. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Well, I think there's a lot to derive from that. That's what you want, dear friends. You want pastors in the churches of Jesus Christ, one with the people, approachable people, no aggrandizement, nothing special, no special elevation. One of the first things that I did here, and the people were very happy to do it when I became pastor of the tabernacle, was to remove the central chair at the Lord's table, which had an extra bit on it, which made it look a tiny bit like a throne. And that's gone somewhere else. And now all of them have the same height at the back. Well, what does that mean? No, you don't want anything delineating the pastor, anything special, anything elevated, not even a hint of it. And that's how it used to be in ancient times. Why, Samuel couldn't be distinguished and recognized. He's walking along without any retinue, and he has to announce himself to Saul. I think that's precious, and that's wonderful. Verse 19, Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me unto the high place, for ye shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let thee go, and will tell thee all that is in thine heart, which probably means I will tell you your life story. It's going to be one of the signs. Saul is going to be given certain extraordinary signs that Samuel is indeed a prophet of God who has rightly identified him and designated him to rule and to be king. And the first is that this remarkable seer will know all about him. And then there's good news about the asses, the donkeys, in verse 20, and they're being found. And then when Samuel announces that he is to be king, verse 21, Saul answered and said, Am not I a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? He cannot understand it. He has no claim, apart from the fact that his father is rich and powerful. He has no special claim to be a king, and various things take place which we won't go into tonight because our time is already up, but soon there'll be private conversation. There'll be an anointing of Saul as king. There'll be signs. And the next phase will be the introduction of the monarchy completely and entirely. A punishment. That's what it'll be. A warning and a message to the New Testament church. That's us. But a means, like the law itself, to bring the people to hunger and thirst after the true king. Value the New Testament pattern church. See lessons for us in all these events of the Old Testament. These things are for our learning, teaching us principles, giving us insights, precious warnings and precious promises. And whatever we do, let us not allow our faith to fail. Faith in God, prayer to Him, never substituting methods for prayer and all this kind of thing. That's the message of these chapters. Don't be like them and let go of faith and allow any form of idolatry in. Well, God willing, we'll continue to look at lessons from the monarchy. Let's close this evening singing hymn number 6.